Welcome to New World Notes, jotted down by yours truly, Kenneth Doust. Today we'll hear the first half of a very interesting conversation I had on April 6 with political scientist Michael Parenti. We talk about a number of ideas Michael discusses in his new book, God and His Demons, just out from Prometheus Books. I first heard Michael Parenti's voice maybe 15 years ago on that admirable radio show, Maria Gallardin's TUC Radio. Parenti provided a language to make sense of current events and why they were occurring. A language that just clicked, that made better sense of my own experiences than the official narrative of the entrenched interests found in the commercial media. To learn more about his work, check out www.michaelparenti.org. That's P-A-R-E-N-T-I, michaelparenti.org. We'll hear the first half of our conversation today. We start out by talking about some of the sins of the Christian bigwigs, the child molesters, the Inquisition leaders, the televangelist con men. Then we'll move on to the Buddhist establishment, which proves to be not a whole lot better. I hope you'll stay tuned. I'm pleased to have on the line with us Dr. Michael Parenti, whose voice you've heard many times on the show before, speaking to us over the phone from his lair in Berkeley, California. We're going to be talking about Michael's new book, God and His Demons, just out from Prometheus Book. It's a study of God and his followers and the damage that they've done mostly. Michael.
Yes, Ken.
God has been the subject of a lot of writing lately. I know Chris Hedges has, you know, numerous books out about him lately. And Chris Hitchens, who is reveling in his own atheism. And I don't gather that you're an atheist from reading the book. But tell me, what led you to publish this book at this time?
It's just a subject that I find very fascinating because it speaks to the human condition, how people can construct systems of belief and how they can act with an unspeakable venality and cruelty in those systems. And I'm talking about much of the religious leadership throughout the world and throughout history. Not all of it, though. I make it clear that there are many, good souls who are religious people.
Mm-hmm.
But I haven't read Hedges or Hitchens on this subject. I just did my own book, and it's about the enormous distortions and insanities in the Bible. That's one of the things it's about. It's about the plundering after money that so characterizes religious organizations of various kinds. It's about the abuse of power and control that these religious leaders and stalwarts exercise over their flock and over innocent and vulnerable people, of which we see an endless examples of this keep breaking out in the press, of course, going all over the place. They're focusing on the Catholic Church, but I have a section in the book called Pedophilic Protestants, and it points out that celibacy is not the cause of child rape.
Right
now, all sorts of people are celibate, and they don't go around mauling or raping little children or youth or adolescents. And there's a real problem of child rape in, and let's call it that instead of molestation or abuse,
okay. Which
sounds almost like it just means you touched the kid. And they do more than that. They do some really awful things and very destructive things on these kids. But, you know, you have Protestant ministers. It's a problem among Baptists. You have people organizing against the Baptist associations and calling for redress of grievances. And every Protestant minister is married or has the right to get married, so it's not celibacy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not homosexuality that causes this either. The Roman Church is raising a hard line against homosexuality, both in the clergy and outside, and I see that as a diversionary tactic. They talk about homosexuality not only as a sin, but also as a personal disorder. So they're not just theologians and moralists, they're also little Dr. Freuds, and they've decided these are disorders that people suffer from.
And yet they go to such extreme lengths to protect the pedophile clergy and keep them from being removed, keep them from being arrested.
And what they're now covering up is the cover-up. What they're now trying to cover up is all these years of cover-up. And that process of covering up the cover-up is going on all the time right now. Cardinal Levada, who was a cardinal of a major archdiocese here in the States, had a decades-long record of covering up for some of the most notorious pedophiles. I mean, putting them right back into schools, putting them right back into orphanages, putting them right back where they could access kids and all that. It was so bad, he had to be removed. And you know where he landed? He landed in the same place that Cardinal Bernard Law, who also
Vatican.
Was removed. The Vatican, right.
They kicked
Law
him upstairs.
Ended up living in a castle in the Vatican, answerable only to the Pope, and Levada ends up in the second most powerful office of the church. He occupies the office that Ratzinger occupied before he became Pope, now Pope Benedict XVI. It's called, what is it, Congregation?
Office for the Congregation, the Enforcement.
Well, the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith.
Yeah.
Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith is a mouthful, really dull mouthful term for an office that used to be called, right up until 1965, it used to be called, over the centuries, Office of the Inquisition. Those were the guys who burned and tortured tens of thousands of people, at least tens of thousands, women, men, and even minors. So Levada, that's where he ends up. This is not removing somebody. This is not demoting somebody or divesting. This is giving them, putting them in the lap of luxury, or in the case of Levada, the lap of power.
Mm-hmm.
He's right there. And while everybody's focusing on Benedict, you really should focus on John Paul II. He didn't move for about 20 years. He rejected and ignored the complaints that were coming up along the way. First, he dismissed it as an American malady, as if that's to excuse it or minimize it or something. And now, of course, it's just about in every country that there is. Anyway, that's only one problem. Then there's the problem of money and how money is taken. And there you can't beat the Protestant televangelists in America. No, when it comes to money, they can even match that, the Vatican, on that. And you know, and you've just got to wonder about people are so desperate, people are so lost, they're living on their crumpled checks. That guy Robert Tilson, he would pitch his fundraising at about the time when the Social Security check arrives, at about the second week in the month, and he'd ask people, "You send me money to the, you send God's mission money, and you'll get back tenfold." And then he'll tell a little anecdote about a real or imagined person who sent a crumbled $10 bill in or pledged $30 a month, and who ended up winning some big prize or something. He said, "You see, God provides, and I have a special power. I can talk to God and such." Mm-hmm. And you sit there and you say, "What is this? Is this the 11th century I'm in, or is this the 21st century?" But people, in their desperation, do seem to be easy targets for these sharks. You know,
one of the most interesting parts of your book for me, and newest to me, was the chapters in which you show that when it comes to pedophilia, the Protestants are running neck and neck with the Catholics. And this has gotten much less publicity, of course, in this country.
And there's even a stray rabbi here or there, and a stray imam, and a Muslim imam here, one or two.
A Muslim imam, and the Buddhists don't escape without a spanking either.
Well, the Buddhists, that's a different kind of... much of Buddhist practice is really just an operational thing, not a theology, at least the way it's done in American communities like Boulder, Colorado, or Berkeley, California. And it focuses on meditation and visioning a cosmic force of some kind.
Mm-hmm.
But organized Buddhism, like every organized religion, as the history of Tibetan Buddhism shows, it was riven with denominational wars and hatreds of each other, where they killed each other and wrote prayers about killing and smashing the heads of their enemies and such, and including the Dalai Lama's own denomination.
Mm-hmm. Why don't you tell us more about that, Michael? Because that was another part of your book that really, really struck me, the Ancien Regime in Tibet, run by the Buddhist monks and aristocrats, was not paradise. And when the communists muscled in, the Chinese communists muscled in, they didn't do nothing but harm. They did some good. And the CIA was involved, too.
Well, the Chinese communists did some harm also, but mm-hmm. they did do... Well, things were so bad that the Chinese came in, and the first thing they did was get rid of this landed class that had a whole population reduced to serfdom and slavery. Mostly serfs, but some people were even slaves. They were sold like property. And these serfs were taxed up one side and down the other. You're taxed if your sheep gave birth to a lamb, you had to pay a tax on it. If somebody in your family died, you had to pay a tax. If somebody was born, you paid a tax. If somebody got married, you paid a tax. If you had to go to another town looking for a job, you had to pay a tax. And it went on. I mean, and taxes and debts were inherited sometimes. A person would inherit his father's and grandfather and great-grandfather's debt, which he would still have to be working off and trying to pay off to the Lord. And you had this feudal aristocratic class, just like Christendom in Europe in the Middle Ages, made up of upper clergy and secular aristocrats together, forming an aristocracy. The biggest concentrations of wealth were the monasteries themselves, including the one that the Dalai Lama lived in, with something like 200 servants, most of whom were slaves. Mm. You had 9-year-old boys in old Tibet being taken out of their peasant homes, taken from their parents, and being brought to the monastery to serve as servants, to become monks, and to be sexually used. Now, and some were put into the military to become soldiers for the... There was a gendarmerie. It's not true that old Tibet had no military. It did have an army whose major function was to hunt down runaway serfs and runaway slaves, people who had been abused and such. So Tibet was not a really pretty place. And the communists got rid of the usury. They got rid of the inherited debts. They got rid of the feudal system and gave a lot of the land to collectives, peasant collectives, to run on their own. And people started living better. People got medical care for the first time. Their kids got education for the first time, except for the kids that went into the monasteries. They got educated into the religion, theocratically. But so you got a secular education and all that. So I would have to say, and this doesn't endorse Chinese communism, because I think the Chinese communist rule has many, many problems and mistakes, and not just mistakes, but crimes. And by the way, every country in the world, the governments have committed crimes, but which is not to shrug this one off and all. But they definitely were the lesser of two evils, I think. I think old Tibet was quite terrible. And by the way, can I add, Ken, that the reaction I got from the loving, peaceful, forgiving Buddhists who read that was pretty close to getting mugged by teabag. That's what it sort of felt like before this ever happened. Yeah, go ahead.
We're talking with Michael Parenti, political scientist and a fixture on this program, about his new book, God and His Demons. After a break, he'll have more on Senator Grassley, biblical sins and abominations that nobody seems to care about anymore, creationism, intelligent design, and the theory of evolution. Turns out, like Jerry Falwell, Michael Parenti also has a few doubts about Darwin. Unlike Falwell, Parenti thinks that the science of the past four centuries still has something to offer. And by way of preface, let's have a brief science lesson from America's other great Jewish singer-songwriter from Minnesota, born with the name of Zimmerman. Here's the younger one, Roy.
God made the world in 7 days. Well, that's 1 week to be specific. Now that's what I call scientific. say hallelujah, sing his praise, 4042 B.C. On Monday, August 27, he made the earth and sky and heaven. Then he punched out at 503, then he made Adam and then Eve. The garden for them to inhabit, the apple right where Eve could grab it. And I got proof, 'cause I believe creation science 101. In the beginning it begun, and you are just beginning to educate yourself when you shun evolution. Then Cain and Abel he begat, and they begat all of the rest to us, which means they must have been incestuous. I'm gonna have to pray about that. There might be sinners in this class who might believe in Charles Darwin. I guess that's just their loss and our win, because I'm gonna flunk their ass if you make Genesis your text. You'll laugh at Darwin and what he sees to be the origin of species, 'cause he's just plain oversexed. Creation science 101. You ain't no monkey's great-grandson. You got a research paper due about 50 reasons to shun evolution. Don't let them hand you that old jive about survival of the fittest. That notion don't pass the bullshit test, 'cause look at me, I'm still alive. God made the world just like it is. He made the fossils just to tease us, old bones to test our faith in Jesus. Yeah, this'll all be on the quiz. Creation science 101. Now Armageddon, your homework done, because when this semester's through, it's straight A's for students who shun evolution. The kids get such an education when they shun the heretical theory of the development of life on Earth over millions of years by means of spontaneous genetic mutation.
This book is a marvelous compendium, catalog of just about a survey of anything awful, rotten, nasty, mean-spirited that's been done and justified in the name of religion. But you go a step further. It's not just that the beautiful, transcendent, nurturing, true religion is being corrupted by corrupt practitioners. To some extent, intrinsic in a lot of religions themselves is a lot of nastiness, rottenness, violence, sexual oppression, etc., etc., etc. The Old Testament, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Old Testament consigns women to a really subordinate and suppressed condition. The Old Testament is full of all sorts of rules and admonitions.
Some of which we pay attention to, and some of which we blissfully pretend are not there, like the prohibitions against usury.
Yeah, the Bible has a lot of prohibitions against usury, and you've got credit card companies that are, I mean, they've even rewritten the usury laws in many of the states of this country to allow for, you know, usury used to be 7%. I think anything over 7% interest was usury in some states. Well, now your credit card, you
I'd love to pay 7% on my credit card.
Yeah, exactly. And I gave the example of Senator Grassley, I think, who rails against abortion and against same-sex marriage as a violation of God's word in the Bible. Well, in fact, abortion and same-sex marriage, neither of them are mentioned in the Bible. Mm-hmm. And then usury, which is denounced repeatedly in the Bible, there he says, oh, I can't move against usury. The credit card companies, you know, they make
right.
the rules.
And he's on the
I would be imposing my biblical standards on people who aren't Christians, and I can't mm-hmm. do that. Well, that's funny. He's doing it with these other imaginary sins, that abominations that preoccupy him. Yeah, I have a whole section on that, yeah. too, about the politicos, political, you know, how they want to live their lives is their business, but it's what we have to call to account is two things, the hypocrisy of it,
mm-hmm.
where they can denounce gays, and yet you catch them in men's rooms trying to hustle a little action,
mm-hmm.
Talk about family values, and their devotion to their family, and then you find they've got a girlfriend or a boyfriend on the side, or go visit a male escort or something. The sheer hypocrisy of this is something that has to be called.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing, as far as I'm concerned, nothing. If you want to have something on the side or not have something, that's your thing to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
But the hypocrisy of that, that's the first thing, the hypocrisy. The second is the criminal behavior, as with pedophilia. That's not just something to disapprove of something. There should be criminal actions taken. There should be lawful criminal actions. And the church has been an accomplice in the crime here after the fact. They're accessories to the crime. That's what we're facing.
What do you make of the character Jehovah as he's presented in the Bible?
Well, as I said, if you ever met an individual who was given to this violence and this mass murder and mayhem and rage and whatever else, you would say he's in drastic need of being put in a maximum security institution. At the very least, you wouldn't prattle on about how he works his wonders in mysterious ways.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, I also do talk about conscious design and
working his blunders in mysterious ways.
Right. Intelligent design and creationism. And talk about the question of how do you think of science and theory and fact. There's just a few pages on that, and
mm-hmm.
I think I try to make it as clear and accessible as possible.
I think they're good pages, and maybe our listeners would like to hear a little bit of it. You talk about Darwinism as just a theory, as though theory meant just nothing more than a hypothesis. But you talked about what a scientific theory is, and it's not just a hunch.
Right. They come along and say evolution is not a fact. It's just a theory.
Mm-hmm.
And they're using the word theory to mean just speculative, spin mm-hmm. off the top of your head, or this is my hunch, you know, or something, or my impression. And I point out that the word theory, as it's used in science, is quite different. Theory is the thing that is to be tested and advanced, but it's also the gold standard. It's the thing you want to develop, that you don't juxtapose facts and theory as two mutually exclusive things, but
mm-hmm.
in fact, you need your facts to build and substantiate a theory, but you need theory to organize and give explanatory power to your facts. So that theory is something like the theory of gravitation. You don't
mm-hmm.
say, that's just a theory. I think I'm going to step off this eighth floor here. And
the scientists, they haven't proven it beyond
shadow of
a doubt.
Silly theory about gravitation. Yeah. So you have theories of gravitation, Newton's theory, Einstein's theory. These all relate to very real thing.
Mm-hmm. So the theory of evolution is not in the same order as the theory that Barack Obama was born in Kenya.
Correct. The theory of evolution. Although I'm not a die-in-the-wool Darwinian, I don't mm-hmm. believe his theory of natural selection really explains all that much. I think evolution does work in a lot of other ways, and I think the whole Mendelian idea that acquired characteristics are not inherited is a misstatement, that it's true in certain respects, but in fact, we now know that the DNA can be affected. In other words, there's no way you can use natural selection to explain the porpoise. The porpoise is an animal that was once a land-bound animal with fur and four legs that liked to splash around in the water, like the sea otter. We have the sea otter today. If you look at a sea otter, it's a land animal, whiskers and it breathes through lungs, and it's got little hands and paws. And then you look down further, it's covered with fur, wet fur, because she's always in the water. never comes up on land, really, hardly. And you look at his feet, and he has no feet. He's got flippers. So he's on his way. It is on its way to becoming another one of these creatures that looks more like a fish than a mammal. So none of that's explained, really, by Darwin, as far as I can tell. In some of the Darwinian explanations, they leave something to be desired. That giraffes have long necks because they were able to eat the leaves on the higher branches and all that. Well, you know, that's hardly proven. So natural selection, it really leaves a lot to be desired. And I think there are ways that inherited genes do get modified by the forces of the environment you're in. But I can't prove it. I don't know. And I went into a different field where I went into the study of politics, which is even more ridiculous, and more twisted and distorted. Yeah.
Michael Parenti, chatting about some of the ideas in his new book, God and His Demons, just published by Prometheus Books. In another installment of this show, we'll talk with Michael about how three powerful institutions interact. These are the state, the church, and economic power. And when they do interact, it's seldom good news for the citizens. We'll hear how the Christian right has already conquered the Air Force Academy and is making inroads into the rest of the military. We'll hear about FEMA's very scary plan to use the clergy to suppress rebellion if martial law is imposed. And we'll hear Michael explain why, despite everything, he's not an atheist. New World Notes comes to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. The opinions expressed on this program are condemned as blasphemy, heresy, and abominations by this radio station, the staff and management of which has vowed to burn me at the stake at the first convenient opportunity. Nah, just kidding. Learn more, explore some links, check out some pretty pictures, or find my email address for feedback from our website, newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Thanks for listening. Thanks to Michael Parenti and Illegitimi Non-Carborundum, one and all.
Don't let them hand you that old jive about survival of the fittest. That notion, don't pass the bullshit test. 'Cause look at me, I'm still alive. God made the world just like it is. He made the fossils just to tease us. Test our faith in Jesus. Yeah, this will all be on the quiz. Creation science. What else?